Welcome to the Woodshop Life Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast focused on the craft of woodworking. I'm Hui Hun of the Alabama Woodworker, and I'm joined by my friends Sean Walker of Simple Cove.
Hello, guys.
And Guy Dunlop of Guy's Woodshop.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
This podcast is intended to answer your questions, the woodworking community, and give you some of our perspectives on how we get things done in our own shops. We also want to thank our patrons to our Patreon campaign, Joey Sidneys, Paul Getz, and Tab Adams. Thank you for listening and for supporting the show. If you'd like to support the show, we have one level, and we are simply asking for a small donation to cover the costs of bringing you this podcast. Please go to patreon.com/woodshoplife if you'd like to support the show. All right, with that, let's get started. Guy, what's your first question?
All right, so this is from Dorian, and Dorian asks, I am moving along in my woodworking skill, and I just got a used DeWalt DW735 planer so I can work with some hardwoods. I was wondering what sorts of things I should check, verify before starting it up. It looks to be in decent condition. Well, Dorian, there's not much you can check. Just plug it in and start it up. The things after you want to take a look at is you want to make sure everything is clean. You also want to take some rubbing alcohol, put it on a rag, and clean the rollers underneath to make sure there's no resins or anything on there that might cause them to slip. After that's done, take a board, and if you have a set of calipers, this is real easy. You take a board and you send it through till it cleans off the entire surface, and then take the calipers and make sure that it's getting an even amount on each side. If it's within a couple thousandths of an inch, you should be good. But other than that, that's pretty much it. Make sure the posts are clean. There's not much maintenance to one of those. I had one for a number of years. I used it pretty heavy. The only thing that ever happened to mine is one of the covers for one of the brushes came off the motor. And it caused me all kinds of problems because I spent like a half a day trying to trace down electrical problems that weren't there. And I finally discovered that. But other than that, that's a really rock solid planer. If you got a good deal on it, keep it. Can you guys add anything to that at all?
I had the 734. I bought it new, but I mean, I understand what you're saying, and you've pretty much covered everything. Make sure the rollers are good. Check for, like you're saying, see if there's any snipe or if the blades are dull. If you see any lines in the board, maybe rotate the blades. The 735, you could rotate the blades, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, I think you covered everything. Anything that I would recommend, you done covered it.
The snipe is another good thing you brought up, too, is you put a stray edge across there and that the foremost leading edge and the last trailing edge of the outfeed tables, you want to have those elevated slightly up.
Mm-hmm.
If you put a straight edge across it, there's about a 16th to an 1/8 inch gap in the middle, and that'll help snipe on that particular model.
The planer that I had, my first planer, was actually a Delta equivalent to the 734. And I believe the 734 and the 735 both have the beds raising and lowering, correct? The head raises and lowers, correct? Yeah, so one of the things, and this comes to maintenance, is just making sure that those are properly greased and oiled. I like to use a dry lube so that the chips and the sawdust don't actually stick and over time create this sort of caked on glop.
Is that a technical engineering term, glop?
Yeah. We use it in aerospace engineering quite often.
You ever use the term schmutz?
Schmutz, yeah. Actually, I do use the term schmutz. I grew up in upstate New York, so you know.
I just use crap.
Crap. Schmutz.
But yeah, just making sure that and maintaining the lubrication on the lead screws for the raising and lowering of either the bed or the head, depending on what planer you have. That's about all I can think of in terms of those lunchbox style planers.
That's a good tip because you don't want to fight having to raise and lower the head because there's stuff in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think Sean, you're the next question, right? That was a quick one. Did we want to add anything to that?
No, at 735 is a great planer. I think you're going to be happy with it.
It's a rock solid piece of equipment.
Yep. All right. So my question is from Rustic Grain Designs. And he or she said, I just picked up the Supermax 1938 drum sander. Can you guys speak more about what grits you primarily use and what grits do you keep on hand? Thanks, guys, and keep up the great work. All right. Well, I have the Performax 1632. But I guess that doesn't matter. I keep the 80, 120, and 150 on hand. And I primarily use the 120 for stuff like glue ups, removing the glue line. And if I have some tear out on a board, if it's a figured board going through the planer, I'll run it through the drum sander. I will back down to 80. For instance, when I made a bench out of the top of it was a live edge slab. And since my planer is not big enough to run it through there, I first flattened it with the router sled, and that left grooves on the top and the bottom of the live edge board. So I would run it through the drum sander with 80 grit in the drum sander to remove those little lines that are on top of the board. Now I will, if I start with 80, I will put in the 120 grit and follow that up with the 150 grit just to smooth it out a little bit. So I'm not sanding as much, because it's going to, of course, if you just leave an 80 grit, it's going to leave some pretty gnarly grooves that you're going to have to sand with your orbital sander. But I primarily just keep 80, 120, and 150. Hui, what do you keep on hand?
I keep 80, 120, and I keep 220. And when I was talking with the guys at Supermax, they were saying that you can skip 180 if you're running 220 a couple times through. And so that gave me the ability to kind of go to a little bit of a finer grit. To be honest, I actually haven't used 220 at all. I bought a roll of it and I haven't used it. Mostly I keep 120 on the drum, and I'll put the 80 in just to, if I need to run a couple boards through initially and then put the 120. But normally I just keep the 120 on hand because board is or veneer is pretty close to where I want it anyway. I haven't really used the 80 that much. And honestly, I think I might have used the 220 a couple of times. So 120 is really the one that I use the most, but I do have the three others. How about you, Guy? What do you have on hand?
First thing I want to mention about drum sanders, I have a 1938. That's what you have also, isn't it, Hui?
Yes. Love it. It's a great, great machine.
It's a good machine. Most important thing to remember about a drum sander is that it is a sander, not a thicknesser. I think we've talked about this before.
Yep.
I keep 80, 120, 180, and 220. I mostly keep 180 on it. And unless I'm really trying to flatten something, I just do a couple passes with 180 and I'm done. And then I do a hand sanding or with random orbit sander on 220. Sometimes I'll just put 220 on it and just do that. Gluing up a tabletop, I've done, you know, a couple times now, and I'm not going to pat myself on the back because next time I do it, I'll screw it up. But I am pretty good at getting a really nice flat glue up where I don't have to really put it through the drum sander and use something as aggressive as an 80 grit. There's been a couple times where I have. Now, when I'm resawing my own veneer, one side of it has been thickness planed. The other side is rough sawn through the bandsaw. That's really the only time I use 80 grit is when I'm getting rid of those bandsaw marks. Mm-hmm. And that's the side I'm typically going to put down onto the substrate anyways. So that gives me a good tooth for the glue.
Right.
But most of the time I keep 180 on it. And sometimes, like I said, 220.
Yeah. I primarily keep the 120 on because I get a lot of tear out on my planer, and that's primarily because I use a lot of figured woods in what I make. So the 120 works best for me, but it sure is a lot of sanding when you go down to 80 and or stop at 120.
Oh yeah, it really leaves a lot of really deep grooves in there. One thing, I'm going to get off into the weeds here really quickly. You mentioned you're getting a lot of tear out on figured woods through your straight knife planer. If you miss that with some water before you put it through, It will really cut that down quite a bit.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I'll have to give it a try. Dull blades too, I'm sure, but I'll give that a try.
When I'm resawing veneer, I normally just go with the 120, but it usually takes me a couple more passes than you, Guy, to go through. But then again, I think one of the reasons why I do is because I'm too lazy to switch out to 80 grit. But I'm able to get it down with 120. It just takes a little bit longer.
Yeah, I put the 80 on it, and usually two passes.
Yeah,
I'm done.
Takes me a little bit longer. But again, it's probably laziness for me not wanting to switch out the grits.
I've heard that about you.
Yeah,
lazy with the grits.
Real lazy. Lazy with the grits.
All right, sounds good. Hui, what do you got for us?
All right, so this question is from Bill. For building cabinet cases, what's your favorite joinery technique? Well, Bill, my favorite joinery technique right now is mainly the domino and pocket holes to join my cabinet sides and tops together. I'm using the domino for alignment purposes, and then I'm using the pocket holes so that I don't have to actually clamp the pieces together. In the past, before I even had any of those tools, before I even had a pocket hole jig, I was using dados and rabbits and brad nails if the sides weren't being shown in any way. Then I went to a biscuit joiner and pocket holes. Again, the biscuit joiner was used for alignment purposes, and then the pocket holes was used simply as clamps. And this is also to add that I add a half inch back to all my cabinet carcasses, and that helps stiffen up the carcasses. But now that I have a domino, I don't use the biscuit joiner as much. And so that's what I'm using as my alignment tool, and then the pocket holes to clamp everything together. You don't need the biscuit joiner or the dominoes, but the reason why I use it is it kind of helps get things moving along a little bit faster, and so that I don't have to actually wait for things to set up in clamps before going on to the next carcass box. Guy, how about you? What do you use?
Well, I'm taking this question one of two different ways. When it says for building cabinet cases, it could be for something like cabinetry. It could also be something like a cabinet case for a chest of drawers,
mm-hmm.
or a wall cabinet or something like that. So I agree with everything you said as far as like cabinetry, boxes, kitchen cabinets, shop cabinets, things like that. The biscuits or dominoes are really nice, mainly because when you put the pocket holes in and you screw those things home, they tend to shift. And it really helps prevent that from moving around. If it's a fine furniture project, I'm typically going to do rabbets or dovetails or dominoes. one of those three. It really depends. If I want to show off a little bit, I'll do dovetails. But you know, mm-hmm. I'm not a guy that has to put dovetails on everything. You know, I always hear that, you know, oh, the hand cut dovetails are a sign of true craftsmanship. No, that's just a sign that you can do hand cut dovetails. That's all it means.
Completely agree.
There's the whole piece has to reek of craftsmanship, not just the dovetails. Anyways, what you're saying is correct. And I just got through building a bunch of shop cabinets. So I'm right in the middle of that. And I didn't use any biscuits or dominoes. I just clamped them all up and drove the screws home.
Mm-hmm.
And I put enough pressure on there where the cabinets couldn't, or the pieces really couldn't move around a little bit. But I've done a lot with before I even got the biscuit joiner. So this was many years ago where I was just putting rabbets in mm-hmm. and then just screwing them in and be done with it. What about you, Sean?
I don't think you guys left any options left for me to say.
Nope. I tried to cover everything so you wouldn't have anything to say.
Well, I don't make a lot of cabinets. The last cabinet I made was a wall cabinet, and I used tapered sliding dovetails. But on cabinetry, made some shop cabinets. The first set I made were uppers, and I used dados and screws because it was painted. So I just filled the screw holes and painted them. And when I made my assembly table, I used brad nails, dados, and pocket holes. So that's pretty much what I used.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Anything else we want to talk about with cabinet case joinery techniques? All right. Well, Guy, we're back. Guy, we're back to you.
Those were pretty easy questions, I guess.
Yeah.
So this next question I'm getting from Zach, and this is a fairly deep question, so hopefully we have a much better discussion on this. Top three types of hand planes every beginning woodworker should own. Brand recommendations are also welcome. Wow. I'd say the first thing would be a block plane. The second would be a number four. And the third would be either a low angle jack plane or a number five. And let me give you the reasons why. First of all, as far as a block plane goes, I've got a little brass Lee Nielsen. I think it's a number 102. I'm not quite sure of the number. I'm not good with the numbers on those things. It's a low angle block plane. It's very small. The steel that's on it holds a fantastic edge on it. And I use that thing for everything, knocking the corners off of boards instead of using sandpaper, cleaning up tenons, all kinds of different things. It's just the handiest little plane I have. The other one I mentioned is a number four. The number four is nice because it's got a very short bed on it. And it kind of, it can work well as a smoother. It can also be set aggressively to take more material off. It's just a good all-around hand plane. I know guys that's, you know, that's all they use is their number four. And since it's a very popular hand plane, it can be gotten very cheaply. I mean, I've got two number fives. I've got one number four. It's a Stanley. I bought it on eBay for, I think, $15 or $20. And I bought a Pinnacle. I bought a Veritas PMV 11 blade for it, which was about $60 or $70, if I'm correct. I might not be on that. So anyways, so for about $70, $80, I got a really good hand plane. And like I said, I reach for that quite often. If I'm not using the block plane, I'm using that. As far as the number five goes, simply you can get like a number six, which is kind of a weird size, or you can get a number seven. I use the number five I actually said a low angle jack, didn't I? Did I say low angle jack?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So four types of hand planes.
that's what I'm going
to
recommend.
I use a number five a lot because I use that to joint boards with, simply because mm-hmm. I don't have a number seven. Mm-hmm. The low angle jack is nice. You know, there's a school of thought with that you can, you know, get different blades to cut at different angles and all that. I really don't get wrapped around the axles with that stuff. I think my blade is at, I want to say 27 degrees. I don't know if that's correct.
That sounds about right.
25 or 27 is what I have.
Probably 25 at the 2 degree micro bevel.
Okay. So yeah, something like that. That is a really good all-around hand plane. It's low angle, so if you get grain that switches on you, it's less prone to tear out. It works really good as a joiner too, because it does have a fairly long bed. It's a very easy plane to learn how to use because it doesn't have all kinds of adjustments and this, that, and the other thing. It's very, very straightforward. And like I said, since it's a bevel-up plane, it does work really well on figured woods too. Mm-hmm. And or the low angle jack, I think it's a number. Is that a number 62?
I believe so. Yeah, that sounds about right. Okay.
The one I have is a Lee Nielsen. Yes, it was expensive. However, it wasn't any more expensive than, let's say, the Veritas. It was about the same price. And I don't have a lot of Lee Nielsen stuff because it is expensive. So that's what I got. All right, Sean.
All right. I would say, this is just my opinion, of course, for the block plane, definitely get a block plane. I started with the rabbiting block plane from Lee Nielsen. It's kind of going to allow you to use it as a block plane, and you can use it, the rabbiting feature, of course. So you kind of get a 2-in-1 on that, and it's a great plane. It's got nice weight to it. It's a low angle, or it's a bevel up, low angle block plane. It's a great block plane to have. The second plane, is a bevel up smoother is what I would get if it were me personally. And that's from Veritas. It's their bevel up smoother. I have two blades that I keep on hand for that bevel up smoother. One with a 30 degree and one with a 45 or 50 degree bevel. I pull that out just for crazy grain because obviously you're going to require more effort pushing the plane through at that 50 degree bevel. So if it's something crazy that the 30 degree won't remove any tear out, or if it's creating more tear out, then I will switch to the 50 degree. Third plane is the low angle jack is what I'd recommend. It depends how much you're going to be using your hand planes. If you know, I have the number 62, it's the Wood River. If you're not going to be using the number five or the low angle jack, the number 62 for jointing purposes, you can keep the bevel up smoother and go for something like a router plane, which is what I probably use. The most, well, probably not the most, but right up there with those other two or three planes is the small router plane for installing hinges. You know, I think it's up to you if you want to go four planes. I definitely would get the router plane, the mini router plane. But those are the four that I recommend. Three if you ditch the router plane.
Yeah, I like the idea of the rabbeting block plane, and because the blade goes all the way to the edge. And that's nice for cleaning up tenons. I do not have one of those. I wish I did.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, jack of all trades in that it's good for that, as well as being a traditional block plane. It is a little awkward holding it at times with the sides open like that. I have, you know, cut myself on the blades because it is, you know, all the way from side to side. So you just got to be careful when you're holding it and not be an idiot like me when I'm cutting myself on the block plane. But it's a great plane to have. Hui, what about you?
So I have to agree with you, Sean. The rabbiting block plane is a great plane, and it was one of the first planes that I got. The reason was because of what you said, having the ability to use it as a regular block plane to chamfer corners, cut down corners. You can even do a little bit of smoothing with it, but also to use it as a joinery plane to shave down tenons if they're a little bit oversized. The next plane that I would suggest is the low angle jack. And the reason is because you are able to switch out those blades. And if you're sort of limited on money, you can get a low angle jack and get two blades and function as two different types of planes, either set up as a scrub plane and a smoother, or set up primarily as a low angle plane for shooting and then have another blade for smoothing. The third plane, I would say, is a traditional number four. So if you have the jack plane now, having a plane solely dedicated to smoothing is nice to have. You can just grab it and smooth a couple of boards or knock down an edge really quickly so that it'll fit a drawer opening a little bit better. So having that dedicated plane to be set up as smoothing is nice to have. As a fourth, I would say a shoulder plane, getting a dedicated shoulder plane, because the rabbiting block plane, while it is a jack of, I wouldn't say all trades, two or three jobs in particular, it can be a little bit awkward to hold for smaller tenons. So getting a dedicated shoulder plane is really nice for those smaller jobs that you have to get in, and smaller corners that you have to get into. Again, because the rabbiting block plane tends to be a little bit bigger, it can be a little bit awkward to wield.
On the shoulders, but not the cheeks.
Correct. Thank you. On the shoulders of the tenons, not the cheeks of the tenons.
I'm just here to correct people, man.
No, man. I didn't mention that, and that could definitely be confusing. Yeah, that's the 3+1 for me.
Well, what kind of number four do you have?
The number four that I have is a 4.5, and it is a Lee Nielsen. And that was a little bit of a splurge because I actually did have a Miller's Falls number four that worked perfectly fine. Mm. And when I got the 4.5, I actually gave my Miller's Falls to somebody as a gift.
It's a nice gift.
Yeah, somebody that was starting. Well, I got the plane the same as you, Guy. I got the plane for $20 on eBay, and I refurbished it, you know, flattened the bottom, and then sharpened up the blade, cleaned it up, got it all nice and pretty, and started using it. And that's a really great way, I think, of getting into using hand planes, because it really gives you the ability to understand how the planes are set up by buying a used one. And it's a small investment. Now, that being said, the Lee Nielsen and Veritas planes are premium planes. These planes are coming to you and straight out of the box, maybe other than putting a micro bevel on the edge, they're going to work, and they're going to work great.
They're ready to go. I've looked at that. The only hand plane I've ever really lusted after was that number four Lee Nielsen bronze one.
Yeah.
And it's actually, I think it's less expensive than the cast iron one too. Anyways, it's still expensive. Mm-hmm. One of these days.
That being said, those planes, straight out of the box, they're going to function and work. And if you don't have the time and you have the budget, go with a premium plane. You know, you're not going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to go off in the weeds again. Have either of you guys ever made your own wooden hand plane, like a Krenov style plane before?
Or a Japanese? No, but I want to.
I don't. That's just not something that I'm interested in.
I think it'd be fun, just as a little project.
Yeah, Veritas has those kits now where it actually has like a lever and all that. But instead of tapping this and tapping that, you can actually adjust it a little bit. And I've looked at those a couple times.
There's one plane that I bought that I have not used, and I only bought it because I love the way that it looks. And it is the Lee Nielsen large scraping plane. It's based off of the Stanley number 112. Such a beautiful plane. I mean, I've not used it. I don't even think that I can set it up right if I wanted to. I've not taken the time, but it's such a beautiful plane, the large scraping plane.
Was it a number 80 scraping plane?
Yeah, I think that's a cabinet scraper.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, the cabinet maker scraper is what they call it.
All these numbers confuse the hell out of me.
Yeah, it's the number 85. It has the open sides and it looks like a traditional hand plane with the scraper blade.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a beautiful plane as well. But I think being a beginner, it's just a personal preference. I would just pay and I know a lot of people are going to disagree with me, but just start off by buying a plane that's in a decent shape, like a Lee Valley or Lee Nielsen, the premium planes. If you can swing it, I say do it. At least on just a number 4 to get started or a block plane to get started. Because if you're a beginner woodworker, it's pretty frustrating if you buy a used plane on eBay that needs to be restored and you can't quite figure it out because you don't know the anatomy of the plane. You don't know how to sharpen it very well. It could lead to a lot of frustration.
That's probably like the biggest thing that dissuades people from using hand planes is they do the cheap rod of eBay or something like that. They just can't figure out how to set the thing up right. And it just never works. And it frustrates them when they put it down and
never go back. Yeah.
Yeah. If you have, you know, once you get a little experience, sure, go buy and restore some planes. But if you can swing it, even I know a guy may not agree, but even, look at some of the Wood River planes. They have gotten a whole lot better since they were first released. So many, probably two or three iterations, maybe even more, maybe even four now. But, you know, they are a decent hand plane for the money. But if you can swing it, Lee Valley or Lee Nielsen would be my preference.
Did you see Rockler came out with their own?
Who's that?
Set of Rockler, the bench dog planes.
Yeah.
I wonder what those are.
I haven't tried them yet, and I haven't seen anybody that has them, so I'm curious too.
Dustin Penner, DP Makes Stuff on Instagram, I think he has a set of those.
And?
Yeah, he hasn't said anything about it. So go bug him if you want to know. There's a lot of options out there to get a decent hand plane so you don't have to mess with it.
All right. So, Sean, I think the next question is yours.
All right. This one comes from Winter Wolf Woodworking. Being a new woodworker, it's easy to get lost in the realm of easy projects or the DIY type of work. What are some projects that you did early on that you learned the most from? Or what are some projects you did later on that you wish you would have done earlier in your career/hobby woodworking? All right. Well, I'm going to start with some of the projects that I did early on that I learned the most from. And the first thing that I built in my shop for shop project wise is wall cabinets. These are some uppers. It introduced me to some of the basic cabinet making skills that were extremely handy. When I made the cabinets, I also made quite a few mistakes. I've wasted money on cherry plywood only to paint them, which was a mistake. But, you know, I was green. I was new at this. So I would say the wall cabinets were something that were a very good experience in first project. And then a set of end tables that I made for my parents when I just started woodworking. And I learned a lot about the joinery methods as far as the mortise and tenon. And I learned the hard way that it's very hard to sand curves with a $35 drill press. So I learned how to stress out over using crappy tools instead of, you know, having the right tool for the job. And I also learned that it's not the smart thing to do to glue panels into the frames, you know, because now, like I mentioned a few episodes ago, they are cracking. So I learned quite a few things from that end tables and the wall cabinets project, but it made me a better woodworker because I made these mistakes. I now know not to buy cherry plywood if I'm going to be painting it. And some of the projects or the most important project that I made later on that I should have made first was the workbench. To have a solid platform that will hold the work while I work on it was so amazing. I mean, it was just a game changer after I built a proper woodworking workbench.
Yeah, but I would think that you'd want to do that later on because you don't really know how you're going to use it until you've been woodworking for a while.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there are a lot of workbench plans out there now that they're similar enough that if it were me, I would have built it first. But, you know, I didn't know what I know now. So I think that's you're right on that, Guy. And a crosscut sled, I waited way too long to build one of those. They're super handy to have and allow you to cut, you know, large panels and small pieces, and just a super handy tool to have in the shop that, you know, I wish I'd have made earlier. I know this is a loaded question. Guy, what about you?
Well, it really depends on what kind of woodworking you want to get into. So let's just assume that you want to become more like we, who's building high-end furniture projects.
Ha, ha, ha.
I think all of us tend to build like the intermediate level furniture type projects. So if you want to get into that, you know, we've talked about this before. A side table with a drawer is a very good project to cut your teeth on. And it doesn't matter if it ends up being firewood, it still gives you a good introduction to joinery, wood movement. Building a drawer, which is a really basic skill, but it's an essential skill, gluing up a top, things like that. Another good thing is a wall cabinet, just a simple, not a shop cabinet, but a wall cabinet. It'll give you a good idea of case joinery, which we mentioned before. It'll allow you to build a door. You can frame it, you can not frame it, you can do all kinds of different things. But again, it's a good exercise in getting to know those specific types of joinery and how they interact with each other on a project. My first project I ever built was, of course, a spice rack. That was, you know, like eighth grade wood shop. And then we built, after that, we built checkerboards. I still have it, actually, my checkerboard. It's horrendous. I don't know what happened to the spice rack, but I do still have my checkerboard. You know, that's a very tough question. And again, it really depends on what kind of work you want to get into. But if you want to get into making furniture, a small table or some type of case piece, like a small wall cabinet, both are very, very good projects for a start to your woodworking, furniture making hobby. What say you, Hui?
The first several projects that I built for me was basically shop furniture. The very first thing was an assembly table, a single sheet of plywood. And the most important thing that I learned from that was the importance of having a flat assembly table. Because this was not a flat assembly table at all. And I dealt with it, but it was me trying to make a flat assembly table on a concrete floor that was not flat. Essentially, I dealt with it for a couple of years. And the problem is that I could not make really, I don't want to say fine furniture, because I'm sure you could, but I had problems with getting things like legs to level out properly because I had an assembly table that was just all wonky. Did it work for cabinetry in terms of like the cabinets I had in my shop? It was perfectly fine. I built my wife's pantry cabinets with it, because you're dealing with sheet goods that are already relatively flat. Again, the thing that I learned on from that was the importance of having a flat assembly table. Pretty much every single piece of shop furniture that I have now has been redone at some point. So this is like the second iteration of my shop furniture. The other thing that I made that I learned a lot from was my router table. The first router table I had the same issue. It was the weight of the router on this piece of plywood that I had ended up bowing the router table surface. And so basically any piece of molding that I wanted to create, whether it was stick and cope and stick door panels, I would get this wave in the profile. And it was because my router table, again, was not flat. It bowed. And so me being on a budget, I didn't have the money to buy a router table that would be stiff enough and flat enough for me. So I rebuilt it again. And so now I have a huge router table cabinet that has a torsion box underneath. And again, that was the same lesson, the importance of having a flat work surface to be able to reference off of. What project do I wish I did earlier in my career, my woodworking career hobby? That would be a shaker style table. I still have yet to make one, but
you're not missing anything from what you've made before. I mean, a dining table with aprons, tape legs, and a top. It's basically the same thing, just larger.
Yeah, but I do wish that I had done that earlier in my career, because I think my hobby, because I think I would have learned some important things early on. But doing a table, or doing, like you said, Guy, case cabinet, so more on the like wall cabinet type things, are perfectly fine as well. To add to what you were saying, Guy, the very first woodworking project I ever did was making a wall hanging notepad with a dowel through it that you could put a roll of notepaper on and rip it off and write notes on. And that was actually in eighth grade as well. And that was something that I had given to my mother, and I think she still has it.
Aww,
yeah, it was terrible. That's so nice. It's so bad. It's just got globs of glue all over it, and the polyurethane is like all thick.
Gobs again.
Yeah, gobs.
Gobs and globs.
Well, gobs and globs.
Since we're telling our first project, I'm gonna go ahead and circle back around and tell you what I made. It was a CO2 car in shop class. We had made little CO2 cars. We raced them. They were attached to a string that had little eye loops or whatever underneath them. That was my first woodworking project, and I actually still have it, and I won first place, and I still have the trophy.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. I may have to make a SketchUp diagram of that and put it out there if you're interested. I'm just playing. But one thing I will say, the workbench, you know, even if you wait on building a workbench, which is understandable, I think you should at least add a vise to whatever your work table is to hold your work. Mm-hmm. Because when I first started, I was using, you know, those quick clamps to hold pieces down when I'm trying to use my chisel or a saw. And it, you know, at the very least, I think a vise of some sort connected to your whatever table you're using is going to be very, very helpful and extremely handy.
Yep.
Yeah. I was going to add that both of you guys mentioned it before too, which is shop furniture, whether it's a rolling cart or whatever. That actually is a really good project, because if it turns out like garbage, nobody cares, because it's shop furniture. It also gives you a good chance to experiment with different types of finishes and things like that. We tend to put a lot of emphasis on joinery techniques and milling techniques and this technique and that technique. The thing that took me years to figure out, and I'm still a beginner at it, is finishing.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing worse than making this project that just, it's perfect in every way, shape, and form, and then you ruin it by putting finish on it.
It is such a complex topic, though. It's very hard to do.
It is a very complex topic. But like I said, if you build shop furniture,
yeah,
that's a good thing to try out different types of finishes on. That's all I wanted to say.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree with you. What I'm saying is very hard. You know, I still screw up all the time.
Yeah.
And I used it. I'd never painted furniture before when I made my wall cabinets. So I was learning how to paint furniture properly. And do I use primer? How many coats of paint? Do I scuff sand in between? Do I apply, you know, a top coat to that? Should I paint cherry plywood? So yeah, it's very tough. I understand what you're saying. Hui, what about you for the final question?
All right. So I've got a question, interesting question from Pretty Good Woodworks. He asks, how do you respond when someone asks you for a custom furniture piece to match a faux veneer from a big box store? Well, I would probably say that it can't happen, or it's not going to match with faux veneer from the big box store. My guess is that the veneer that he's talking about is actually laminate, plastic laminate. A lot of times you can buy this plastic laminate that's basically printed on or stenciled on a wood veneer look. And I know that Ramon Valdez from Ramon Artful actually made an outdoor piece, very beautiful outdoor piece, using plastic laminate that has a faux wood veneer look to it. And such type of such kind of laminate is great for sort of outdoor furniture, but it's also used for countertops and whatnot.
Yeah.
Now, how would I respond to somebody that wants a faux veneer from a big box store? Well, I would educate my client that what I'm using is a natural product and what they're looking at is a manufactured product. And the other thing that I would mention is that wood tends to, especially if it's not sequentially cut, is going to look different from log to log and tree to tree. So how it takes finish from one piece of board is going to be different from the other. That being said, Guy, I believe you actually get your lumber from a source that's about an hour and a half away from you, and they do a pretty good job of picking out boards for you that are pretty closely matched. Am I correct on that in terms of color?
No.
No, okay.
They don't spend time picking through stuff to make sure the color matches. I get what I get.
Well, there are a couple of lumber companies out there. I think Belforce is one, Irion Lumber is another, where they do a pretty good job of keeping track of the boards that are coming off of the log. Now, these are premium products. You're paying a lot more for what you're getting, but what you're getting are boards that are pretty close to color matching in the grain. The other thing that you can do is actually go with real wood veneer or raw wood veneer. When the veneer is coming off of the log, they're stacked sequentially and they come in bundles. And bundles are these consecutively cut sheets that are in 24 to 32 sheets a bundle. And the entire log is called a flitch. So it has several bundles in that flitch. And so when you're wanting to get a piece that looks the same and is matched well, you might want to go the route of veneer, specifically if you're doing tops or panels. So that's a way to go and possibly a way to get the cost down a little bit. The other part of this question is, how do you respond when they're surprised at the price of craft-made furniture? It sounds to me that maybe something wasn't discussed at the very beginning that's sort of important to have with your client, which is what it is that they want made and what their budget is. If you're going down the road of designing something for your client and you haven't talked budget, you've made a mistake. You need to know what price range you're working with. And if it's way below what your time and design is worth, then I wouldn't even bother designing anything at that point. You know, again, it comes down to educating your client, telling your client that the difference between Pottery Barn and Restoration Hardware and what you're doing is production versus a one-person shop producing a custom piece for a client. I've actually never done any of this in terms of producing work for clients, so I'm probably not the best person to answer this question, but I think it segues well into discussion with Guy. You've actually done work for clients, correct?
Once or twice.
Yeah. You had a whole business.
Yeah. It's really easy to say, you know, what's your budget? And because people are going to throw out a number. I mean, it's like if I go to buy a car, people ask me, well, how much do you want to spend? I said, I don't want to spend a damn thing.
Yeah.
I just want a car. But I say that because I'm a smart ass. You know, you do want to get budget out of the way because it does give you a better idea of what the person's willing to spend. But typically, that's a very low number. And they're initially going to lowball it anyways. They want to pay the price for something they're getting from Walmart. And they expect, you know, this piece of craftsman-made furniture for the same amount of money. And it's just not going to happen. Some people get blown away from the price. And I just say, you know, now, I know I'm not the most inexpensive guy in town, but I'll tell you what, I put my work up against anybody else out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'll usually take like two or three objections from the customer and I'll handle them. But if it gets like the third or fourth objection and they're still caught up on this whole thing, well, I only want to pay $300 and you're telling me, you know, $1,500. It's just like, well, I'm not your guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not your guy. Sometimes you're just never going to win that argument, but you have to show value for what you're giving the customer. You have to explain to them. It's like what you said, this is not a production made piece coming off a factory. line are made by a CNC machine. Piece is made one at a time. It's made by hand. It's got hand-applied finishes, blah, 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 and the whole story about that. Mm-hmm. And if the people don't see the value in that, well, then they're just never going to see the value in that. But we're getting to a point in time right now where we were 20, 25 years ago. Everything is cyclical, where people want to know who made the piece of furniture. They're seeing the value in something handcrafted again. And another 5 or 6 years, that'll go away, and people will want mass manufactured stuff, and then it'll come back around again. We are at that point right now where people really do want handcrafted stuff. And depending on the crowd of people you're marketing towards, that demographic, they're willing to pay it.
It depends on who you're marketing it to. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Sean, how about you? Have you made anything for commission?
Yeah, a couple things, but I'm going to answer this from the hobbyist's perspective or point of view, and I'm going to use family members as an example. Like, you know, years ago, my sister asked me to make a cabinet, a small cabinet to hold baby bottles, and then she wanted it to match an existing cabinets in her home. I know it's not a faux veneer, but you know, it's pretty close, I guess. I went and looked at the cabinets to see what color they were and what they were made out of. And, you know, I looked at it as a challenge because, and a fun challenge because I was new to woodworking, and this would give me the opportunity to work with coloring woods. It depends on, from a hobbyist perspective, how big is the project, if it's something small, and it looks like it's something that you could match with a few stains or dyes. I mean, I took it on because it was a fun project and allowed me to learn how to color wood and put a nice finish on it. So that's how I would handle that. And how do you respond when they're surprised at the price of craft-made furniture? Again, I'm going to use family members as an example on that. They're like, can you make me this? And it's, I don't know what it is, but it would take half a sheet of plywood. Or they could buy it on Amazon for $13.95. And I'm like, you do realize that I'm going to have to buy a full sheet of plywood unless I go to Home Depot or Lowe's, which is 35 minutes away. And it's going to cost me that same money in material alone. And that's not including the time, the wear and tear, and just explain to them all of the materials and all of the time it takes. And then they'll understand, or, you know, or they won't. Most likely, hopefully, if it's family, at least they'll understand. And you'll just say, pay the $13.95, use Amazon Prime, which I'm sharing with you anyway, and get it sent to your house. They should understand that. But that's how I look at it from a hobbyist perspective. It depends on the project and if it's going to allow me to learn something new or to experiment. But if it's for like a client or something, yeah, most likely I wouldn't take that job on just where I am in my woodworking knowledge and level.
The first part of the question of a custom piece of furniture to match a faux veneer from a big box store, my take on that is to say, I can't do that. It's apples and oranges. I'd just say, well, I can get somewhere close to it, but I can't match that.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to try.
Yep.
Yeah, it's kind of risky if you say you can get close and then when it comes time to deliver it, they don't agree that what your close is compared to their close and just, to, you know, not happy with it.
And another thing too, getting back to the pricing too, one of the things I've said a lot in the past, and people get it when they say, you know, yes, it's X amount of dollars, but you're also talking about a week out of my life or 2 weeks out of my life to make this one piece, you know, mm-hmm. And it's a labor of love for me. And every piece I make, I feel like I'm giving birth. This becomes, I mean, literally, it becomes a part of me.
Yeah.
I may sell it or give it away or do whatever with it, but still, I remember, hell, I don't remember what I had for breakfast this morning, so I shouldn't say that. But I remember just about every piece I've ever made. I remember all the mistakes I've made on those pieces. And I think that rings true with people. So you say, you know, hey, I'm not trying to make $150,000 or $200,000 a year doing this. I'm just trying to eke out a living, man. And you're asking me to build something for you. It's going to take me a week or it's going to take me 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah,
how much
custom?
Yeah. So I'm it's made one at a time. Mm-hmm. So what's your time worth, you know, Susie customer?
Yeah.
if I asked you to spend a week of your life doing something, what's that worth to you? Mm-hmm. And people get that. So,
but yeah, Hui, you're right. You got to get it. You got to get that squared away at the very beginning.
Yeah.
Set expectations.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I think that wraps us up for this show. Please remember this podcast is here to answer questions from the woodworking community. So if you have woodworking questions you would like answered, you can send them through the podcast contact page at woodshoplifepodcast.com or DM us through Instagram at woodshoplife. We would also like to thank everyone who left us a 5-star review on iTunes. It really helps us in the search rankings. And of course, we truly appreciate the support and the feedback. And you can reach me at alabamawoodworker.com. All the links to my social media are on my website. Where can we find you, Guy?
At guyswoodshop.com.
Sean, where can we find you?
SimpleCove.com, at SimpleCove on Instagram and YouTube. That's where I can be found.
Hey, guys, thanks for a great episode. We'll see you next week.
All right, we'll see you.